Wind turbines are popping up, costs are plummeting, technology's advancing, and that's creating a healthy gust of new jobs in the wind energy sector. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this News Buzz edition of our program, we'll hear about a new report that shows wind energy in the country is booming and how Iowa fits in as a leader in the sector. Also, the amazing new F-35 fighter jet helmet, made in part by Rockwell Collins of Cedar Rapids. Are more psychiatric beds needed in the state? A second year of space camp at Iowa State University, and the popular singer Ryan Adams may have saved an Iowa musician's career with a single tweet. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on our News Buzz editions on Fridays to wrap up the week with some items we didn't get to otherwise during the week on our talk shows. On Tuesday, Cedar Rapids-based Rockwell Collins unveiled the latest version of its helmet-mounted display system. It's part of the next generation of technology for our nation's fighter pilots. The new fighter jet helmet that the Rockwell Collins display is part of is on its way to being standard issue for the nation's new F-35 fighter jets. Each one of these helmets costs some $400,000. It's so advanced it can allow pilots to see through their plane, so to speak. Tom Schnell joins us, Associate Professor of Engineering. He's an aerospace engineer, director of the Operator Performance Laboratory in the Center for Computer-Aided Design at the University of Iowa. Tom, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. How are you?
I'm fine. Tell us more about this helmet. What sets it apart from previous generations of helmets?
It's really a quantum leap in technology. Much when aircraft did not have head-up displays, which are the pieces of glass you might have seen on the glare shield of fighter jets where pilots can look through. There were times when pilots didn't have that, then head-up displays became the norm in the 70s and 80s and obviously are still there today. That helmet is a quantum leap, at least of that magnitude, but maybe more. It provides a technological platform that will enable the provision of information to pilots for many years to come.
What is meant by seeing through the aircraft? The pilot is in the cockpit. He can turn his head and actually see through the aircraft. In what sense?
The aircraft has cameras mounted on different parts of the airplane, looking out from the airplane. Almost like in some cars now, you have a backup camera when you put in reverse and you drive backwards, you see what's behind you. In the F-35, it's very similar in that there's not just one pointing back, but there's one pointing in every quadrant. And as the pilot is moving his or her head, a tracking device measures where the head is pointed and will pick the right camera so that you can get an external view being projected right into your eyes.
Mm-hmm. And the camera, I understand the helmet is watching you. It's watching your eyes and detecting your head movement, but also your eye movement.
Not the eye movements. It's basically figuring out where your head is pointed, and it'll pick the right camera on the jet to give you what will be seen from that vantage point. And if that means looking down, then that's what you'll get.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what a fighter pilot, a modern fighter pilot in the U.S. is experiencing or will be experiencing in the F-35, the challenges that a pilot faces and the engineers that support a pilot, because there's so much data, right? And that's the key, to limit that data?
And provide the right data at the right time. So mind you also that the F-35 is a single-seat cockpit, so where other aircraft like an F-18 ERF would have two pilots sharing the workload, in the case of an F-35, that single pilot has to do both flying the jet, navigating, but then also executing the tactical portions of the flight as well. And all that information flows into one Mark I brain, if you will, and it could be very easily too much information. So designing the system to give you the right information as far away from the threat that you're dealing with, so that you have enough time to come up with the right strategy, is really what this helmet enables. And it enables it in all quadrants around the airplane, not just where the nose is pointing.
Mm-hmm. How does this helmet system paired with the new F-35 fighter compare with the fighters of some of our potential foes?
Honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. Haven't done an analysis of other nations' aircraft in that we will consider enemy nations. So I don't think I have a good answer for you there.
Mm-hmm. What is your lab's connection with the development of this display system? I know you work with Rockwell Collins in your lab.
We work with Rockwell Collins and have been working for well over a decade. It's a collaboration that we absolutely cherish. In terms of the development of the helmet, we really haven't had an involvement. Rockwell Collins and the government have jointly developed this technology, and we are now going to use a similar helmet, a civilian version of it, if you will, to investigate ways how to continually improve the symbology, that is, the things you would display with the helmet. And one way you can think of this is kind of like an analog to the smartphone. Now you have a smartphone and you can start doing stuff with it. You know, somebody's going to start writing apps for it. This helmet is really kind of a clean slate for the same idea. It'll keep on giving for many years to come as a platform with which you can, quote unquote, develop apps that will support the fighter pilot, not just with the needs today, but the helmet can obviously grow with future needs when new sensors become available or new threats emerge. The helmet will be basically sort of your quote-unquote smartphone platform, and new apps will be developed. So we will be mostly involved in the development of the proper way of putting new symbologies on that display and making the pilot's life as easy as we possibly can.
Does this so-called fifth generation of technology in our fighter jets require a different sort of pilot than previous generations of pilots? If so, what is an optimal pilot for the F-35 and this new helmet system? What type of person?
Maybe there is a difference, but fighter pilots for all eternity have been extremely capable, smart, and adaptive individuals. So I would think you could probably take a pilot from the 20s and teach them how to use it, and they'd be the top of their food chain, if you will, in piloting terms, that they could adapt to it. So it certainly takes a person who can multitask, who can listen to many channels of voice communications, because you never just work one radio channel, but you listen to multiple sources of auditory input, fly the jet basically without having to think about too much about it, so that the flying mechanical parts of it, many times aided by autopilot or stability augmenting systems, makes it very simple, in the sense that the pilot doesn't really devote much attention to it anymore. And then they have still a lot of cognitive capacity to deal with the mission. And we believe the helmet is going to provide so much of the right kind of information that their capacity can be devoted to the mission more so than having to look around in the cockpit trying to assimilate the information from multiple sources, but rather it's all there in one place.
Mm-hmm. We have just half a minute left. Are the F-35s out and flying? Would we perhaps see them in our part of the country ever?
Absolutely. I'm down here in Florida, and I see them every day. So they're flying out there, and they're using currently the ones that are flying are using the Gen 2, but now they'll be in receipt of Gen 3. So they're out there being flown, and they're getting off the ground, so to speak.
Okay, Tom Schnell, thank you so much for these insights. Associate Professor of Engineering, Director of the Operator Performance Laboratory in the Center for Computer-Aided Design at the University of Iowa, talking about the latest version of the helmet-mounted display system created by Rockwell Collins of Cedar Rapids. Thanks again, Tom.
Thank you very much, and have a good one.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now on to another area of advancing technology, one you can see traveling through Iowa quite often. A new report by the U.S. Department of Energy shows wind energy in the country is booming. Wind turbines are springing up rapidly. Costs are plummeting, technologies are advancing, and that's creating a healthy gust of new jobs. It's a development that can only help matters when it comes to reducing carbon emissions. Joining me now, Barry Butler, Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Iowa. He's co-chaired a research and development committee for the American Wind Energy Association and participated on a wind visioning committee through the U.S. Department of Energy. Provost Butler, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Before we zero in on Iowa, tell us more about the big picture nationwide.
Well, as you just mentioned, the annual report that comes out from the Department of Energy, the 2014 Technologies Market Report, just was issued here in August of 2015. It takes a little while to get the data together, but it showed a very, very strong 2014 in terms of installed capacity, lowering of cost, as you've mentioned as well, in some cases in the Midwest, down in the less than 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour, for example. So a lot of good signs for 2014. They also talk a lot about sort of trying to project 2015 then on into 2016. And 2015 looks good, but beyond that, there's some question marks as to where things will go. But right now, it was a good year, and things are looking good.
Mm-hmm. Question marks. So what do you mean by question marks?
Well, it's hard to project too far ahead when there's a number of factors that can come into play. And if you look at any of the renewable energies, you're competing with other forms of generation. You look at natural gas prices right now. You look at environmental policy decisions, not sure, where those would go. And then also a production tax credit on renewable energies. So there's, like anything, there's a number of unknowns out there, and to try to project too far out is not always possible.
Mm-hmm. Iowa is one of the nation's leaders in wind energy. This we know. Listeners to Iowa Public Radio have been proudly reminded of that often. What other states are leaders in wind energy?
Well, Texas is the leader in terms of total installed capacity. They have been a leader since probably the mid to late 1990s, I believe. And if you look at the state of Texas, I believe they have more installed capacity than pretty much every country in the world, with the exception of maybe three or four. Hmm. So they're about three times as much when it comes to installed capacity. When it comes to percentage of electrical generation coming from wind in a given state, Iowa is the leader. We're at about 28%, more than 28% of our electricity comes from wind, which is really a pretty amazing number. Other states that you see sort of on the rise lately in terms of wind, Illinois, I think people that perhaps drive to Chicago might see the number of wind farms along the interstates as you drive through northern Illinois. You're starting to see more growth in other Midwestern states, Kansas. Again, I think they're up in the 23%, 24% range. So you're seeing more of it there. California, of course, has been a longtime player in wind energy, and probably back to the mid-1980s, late 1980s.
Mm-hmm. We've reported on the one challenge for wind energy is the power that's generated has to get to the places where it's needed. We've talked about the controversy surrounding the Rock Island Clean Line, getting a path for the electricity to get out of this state. What are the challenges? If we don't get it out of the state, is there a wall in terms of the wind energy we can produce here in Iowa?
Well, you've hit on an important issue. If you look at the country as a whole, the greatest potential for wind generation is really the central corridor. It's if you were to think of a corridor kind of between northern Minnesota down to maybe Amarillo, Texas, and then maybe a couple hundred miles wide on each side, you have really what a lot of people refer to as the wind belt, and there is significant wind resource availability there. And if you overlay on top of that a map of the United States where people live in terms of population density, most of the people are the density-wise, that is number of people per square mile, is focused on the East Coast, West Coast, and then, metropolitan areas like Chicago and others. So you've hit on the main point, and that is getting it from where the greatest potential is, and that is the potential to generate electricity at low prices to where people live, and transmission is obviously the key issue. One good sign that's in this Wind Technologies Market Report for 2014 is that the percentage of time that electricity generated at wind farms was not able to get out to places where they needed it had dropped quite a bit in the last year. In other words, the buildup of transmission has been reducing that particular factor. So, in other words, that is a technical challenge, and it seems to be moving in the right direction. It's not perfect, but at least the report shows that it's moving in the right direction.
This new annual report by the U.S. Department of Energy on wind energy comes on the heels of the announcement by the president about the Clean Power Plan, a plan requiring our country to use a lot more renewable energy by the year 2030 and a lot less coal, for instance. How does this wind energy report fit into the Clean Power Plan?
Well, it sort of provides the data. The market report is a compilation of data. And by the way, I have to give credit to the authors of it. They put it out on an annual basis, and it really is the gold standard for collecting information from across the country. Quite often you'll have conversations about wind energy, and it's focused around a narrow topic or a narrow region of the country. And this is really a compilation of all data that's coming in, whether it's on production of power, a cost structure, and all of that. So if you look at the report, it provides a good solid foundation to make decisions on, do we have the capacity to generate enough electricity from wind? Where would it be best? What are the price structures in different parts of the country? And they vary quite a bit. So it really does provide a source of good information. In essence, what it says is that wind energy is becoming a very, very viable source of electricity. As a country, we're a little below 5% right now. And the source of information that's in the report says that there's clearly potential to do a lot more. Mm-hmm. Again, like a lot of things, there's many factors that play into it, but it does provide a good source on the technology, the cost structure, and other issues associated with it.
The U.S. almost 5%, as you mentioned, Iowa as a state, some 28%. Are there countries that are doing really well in terms of wind energy in Europe, perhaps?
Oh yeah, of course Denmark is the standard, the gold standard, and Ireland is another one that has a significant amount on percentage-wise. I think as a nation, Denmark is probably over 30-35%. I haven't checked the numbers lately, but again, significant amount of electrical generation from wind. Mm-hmm. Ireland again is another one. Several countries that on a percentage basis are pretty high, but as a country in terms of total installed capacity, the United States is second only to China. And China has been building up significantly in the last couple of years. But the U.S. Passed all of the European countries probably several years ago in terms of installed capacity.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think, but the numbers you're throwing out tell me that if Iowa were a country, if we imagine, it would be a world leader.
It's probably about maybe 10th or 12th on the list. If you were to look at, a lot of the European countries in terms of install capacity, China, of course, probably 12th or 13th on the list.
Hmm.
And the projections show that Iowa has the capacity to go even higher. The numbers seem to point towards having 40% of electrical generation from wind is very doable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I was going. Where does this max out in Iowa and across the country?
Well, that's the latest, you know, in terms of a state, that's the report that came out earlier this year, I want to say in the spring, from the American Wind Energy Association, you know, indicated that that Iowa could hit 40%. You know, it's not beyond the possibilities. As a country, you know, the committee I worked on, Department of Energy committee, looked at different planning scenarios over the next several decades. And you know, as a nation, the original report said 20% as a country. It really looked at a lot of things related to that. That is, does the technology exist? Do we have the manufacturing capacity to do it? Do we have the infrastructure in terms of transmission? And so it really looked at it from a problem-solving point of view, saying if you were to have 20% as a country, could we get there? And the answer was yes, but it also addressed areas where there was work that needed to be done. And but it was clearly possible.
You mentioned wind energy tax credits and policy being a big part of the equation going forward. To what extent, or perhaps can I say, will there be a time when wind energy after this startup phase will not be dependent on government subsidies, tax credits, and so forth?
Oh, I think yes. There's, you know, any technology, if you look at that startup phase, and I think quite honestly we're past that. If you look at the startup phase of any new technology, those incentives are always there to help kind of move it along. And I think a good example would be if you look back when wind electrical generation from wind was first really pushed hard in the U.S. In California in the 1980s. Significant incentives, no question about it. Cost of electricity in those days was very high, let's just say that. You would never buy the electricity today at those rates. It was just beyond imagination, you know, $1.50 a kilowatt hour, just beyond what you would pay. But the incentives helped drive the technology. And if you look at the technology of the 1980s in California, and compared it to what we have today, you know, what's being installed today in America and around the world, it's night and day. There's no question about it. The efficiencies, the size of the turbines, the reliability, all of that has improved so much. And so when you look at things like incentives, as an engineer, I look at it as incentives to sort of move the technology along to the point where it's capable of competing on its own. And that's where we are, I believe. If you look at some of the numbers in the report, the technology has improved tremendously since the 1980s, even in the last decade. If you look at the improvements, I think to the average observer driving along the highway and looking at one of these turbines, you don't see it. What you see is a turbine that looks the same, perhaps, as it did 10 years ago. But the performance, the efficiency, the reliability of that device has improved significantly.
Okay. Barry Butler, Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Iowa. He's co-chaired a research and development committee for the American Wind Energy Association and participated on a wind visioning committee through the U.S. Department of Energy, talking about a new report by the U.S. Department of Energy showing wind energy booming here in Iowa and across the country. Provost Butler, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, are more psychiatric beds needed in the state? A second year of Space Camp at Iowa State University, and the popular Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Ryan Adams may have saved an Iowa musician's career with a single tweet. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. It's News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, we'll listen back to an interview I did with former astronaut Clayton Anderson. He's now on the faculty of Iowa State University, about his second spaceflight operations workshop that took place at Iowa State University, a space camp of sorts, that coming up in just a moment. But first, we learned this week that a third patient has died since being transferred from the Clorinda Mental Health Institute. That's one of two facilities Governor Branstad ordered closed this year as part of a mental health transition plan. Also this week, the citizen-based Iowa Council on Human Services met midweek to hear an update of the state's mental health plans. Covering both of these items, Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief for Lee Newspapers. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
Aaron, tell us a little bit about the patient who died. This is the third from the Clarinda Institute. He was an elderly gentleman, 80 years old. What were the circumstances of his death?
Yeah, and similar to the other two, these were the kind of patients that people were most concerned about when the announcement was made that the two facilities were going to close. These are the like you mentioned, older patients, very severe mental health disabilities. And the biggest concern was just the trauma of moving them from one facility to another would create. Also, they've been in Clarinda, many of these patients, for a long time. The staff there knew how to treat them, was very familiar with them, so there was concerns about that. But at the same time, too, and some of the family members of these patients have said, you know, that maybe their time was coming. So we don't know. We can't pin it 100% on the fact that they were moved out of these facilities, although one of the patient's family members, not this most recent one, but one of the previous patients who passed away, had a family member who said he believes unequivocally that his, I believe it was his brother's transfer led directly to his passing away. So it's the fact that three have happened just since this transition has taken place is raised a lot of concerns with some who were concerned in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the update given midweek about the state's mental health plans that included the Iowa Department of Human Services Director Charles Palmer.
Yeah, so the state a few years ago set in motion a transition to move from all 99 counties had their own individual mental health care delivery systems. And a lot of people felt that was inefficient. There was inequality of services. You could get some services in some counties, but not in others. So what the state did was combined these counties into 15 regions, multiple county regions that pooled their resources. They set a baseline of services. So no matter where you are in the state, there's at least a baseline of services that you'll be able to get. And that really started in 2013. They're just now getting up and running now, and they feel good about some of the early things. They said there's more work to do, maybe some more services to add. But the closing of those institutes plays into all this too, because there's concerns about where patients can go, and there's been concerns about a bed shortage. Although the director feels that that may not be as pronounced as some believe. He talked about that a little bit this week, and a key element to that is a new bed tracking system that they have in place.
Mm-hmm. A bed tracking system, so one would know how many beds were available in these regions under the new system?
That's the idea, and they've never really had something like this before. One mental health advocate I talked to said that in the past they've essentially been flying blind on this, and that this is going to help. So this is a computer program system that'll collect data. Everybody contributes, and they'll be able to tell at any given moment where there's a bed open, how many beds are open, and the goal there is to be able to help when people get those acute needs. When something comes up, when someone has an acute mental health need, that they can find quickly where to get that person so they can get some help.
Mm-hmm. So when you heard from the Iowa Department of Human Services Director Charles Palmer talking about beds and a new tracking system, does what he said and has been saying about beds, the adequate number of beds, match up with what you hear from concerned families?
It did not at first, and that was a very interesting moment in the director's report. And as I talked to the director afterwards, I told them, you know, whenever I do a story on mental health issues, I almost always hear from families and advocates about a need for beds, that there's a bed shortage out there, that when people have these acute needs, there's nowhere for them to go. So for him to say in that presentation that he doesn't necessarily believe there is a need for more beds, that was striking. What he said to me afterwards was, it may not be a case of more beds. There's 700, roughly, beds across the state. It may not be a case of a need for more beds. It may be a case of specializing, finding the right places for the people who need that care. So not taking up beds when someone else may have a greater need. So, and that's where the tracking system comes into place too. I think their hope is with that data on hand, with a little bit of organization, they can get people to where they need to go. And then that will help them have space and services available for when people have those really acute mental health needs.
Back to the third patient dying since being transferred from the Clarinda Mental Health Institute. Are people looking out for other patients who may be similarly older and frail if that was a contributing factor to these deaths?
I know that for sure there is one family member who is already talking about looking into having her family member moved to another facility, and her family member was also a former Clarinda patient who was moved to the facility in Perry, which is where these three individuals have passed away. So it's an ongoing concern.
Right.
Absolutely. Like you said, it was for these people, these family members from the start of this process, and the fact that this has happened three times is only exacerbated those mm-hmm. concerns.
Right, and in the Des Moines Register investigation into this, published several weeks ago, the paper revealed that 8 of 10 of the patients transferred from Clarinda were sent to nursing homes rated as below average or much below average in overall quality by a federal registry. And I'm wondering, given that, this investigation and what's happened since, have there been repercussions or will there be repercussions for Governor Branstad?
Well, that'll be interesting, and we'll time will tell. Director Palmer did this week stand by the facility in Perry, said he believes they're still giving good care, but obviously it's something that people are going to be watching closely. And like I said, if we have another death, I mean, it's only going to continue to draw even more attention to this. Again, I do throw in the caveat that with these three patients, the patients' family members have said that they can't say for certain that it was the move from one facility to the other that led directly to their passing away. But it's obviously a cause for concern. It's something that a lot of people will be watching closely.
Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief for Lee Newspapers, thanks for taking a few minutes to join us.
Absolutely. Anytime, Ben. Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come a little bit later in the program, how the popular singer Ryan Adams may have saved an Iowa musician's career with a single tweet. But first, it's been a full and busy week for the 12 undergraduates studying space flight operations at Iowa State University in Ames. The juniors and seniors have been putting in 11-hour days during the workshop offered by Iowa State's Department of Aerospace Engineering. It's designed to give students a taste of the operational aspects of spaceflight training. So some lessons include scuba diving, skydiving, wilderness survival, and flight simulation. Former astronaut and current Iowa State University faculty member Clayton Anderson created and runs the program. Anderson retired from NASA in 2013 after two trips to the International Space Station. He's a graduate of Iowa State University, and now he's an Iowa State Distinguished Faculty Fellow in Aerospace Engineering. I spoke with him last year at this time and began by asking him how that very first space flight operations workshop was going.
Well, the week's been going quite well. I think the students are very excited and enjoying what they're learning. This is a prototype. It's something that we hope to make sustainable with time here at Iowa State and provide the opportunity to more than just six students at a time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the activities that I named there, how do they relate to the operational aspects of space flight training? I mean, some of them are obvious, flight simulation, but others, scuba, wilderness survival?
Right. The whole idea here is that operational thinking astronauts are better astronauts. Operational thinking engineers, I believe, are better engineers. And so the idea here was to take experiences that I had received as an astronaut in training that made me begin to think and act more operationally and to provide that same impetus to the students. And some of those activities are things like scuba diving when you're in a very extreme environment where following procedures and making sure your equipment is operationally functional can save your life. And in addition to that, we're going to do skydiving, which is another similar event that helps you think more operationally. And when we threw them in the simulator this morning, the virtual simulator of the space station, and created a fire on board and filled the station with smoke and then asked them to react to it based on some rudimentary procedures we provided, it was pretty obvious that their stress level went up quickly.
Oh, I would imagine. Were you happy with their reaction?
Absolutely. You know, we have to scale this down a lot, obviously. But their abilities and their reactions to the situation were actually quite good. So we're very pleased with what they did today. And all the activities are designed to be extremely exciting and interesting for the students and a little outside the box.
Mm-hmm. So define this a little bit more, operational thinking. What does it mean to think like an astronaut?
Well, the example I try to use, and I'm not sure yet if it's a good one, but imagine a hotel in space is being designed. And the company doing that design wants to hire Iowa State University graduates. When you imagine using that hotel and that hotel's bathroom for the very first time, and you are not a professionally trained astronaut, that bathroom in the hotel needs to be as intuitive and designed to be as easily functionable as possible by a layperson, if you will. And so if these students are more trained in thinking operationally, they'll think like the operator that's going to have to use that bathroom in that hotel in space. They will hopefully then make a more effective, a more intuitive, and a simpler design that will allow people to not have to undergo a boatload of training to be able to experience spaceflight.
So this workshop is a prototype, and you hope to grow it into what, a minor or a major at ISU?
Well, I think we need to walk before we run, but my goal would be to have an academic process through which the kids could both receive credit and perhaps even a minor degree or a certificate, they call it at Iowa State, such that there's a clear documentation of the extra activities that they participated in so that employers can see that. We do a great job with fundamental education here at ISU in the engineering department, but adding this operational training for these kids, I hope, will set them apart from other institutions. And in order to do that effectively, I think we'll need something that provides the credit for them, perhaps as a minor degree in spaceflight operations.
What is your vision? You talked about a hotel in space, but your vision overall in the future of this commercialization of space and the employment that it will provide?
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine Orville and Wilbur on the beaches in Kitty Hawk in 1903. They had no idea that their invention was going to lead to worldwide air travel, where people today simply climb on an airplane and go to their seat in business class or in coach, and they know exactly what to do. They know where the bathrooms are, how to function there. They know how to pull out the tray table and deal with the oxygen mask. You know, it's all intuitive to them because of a good operational design. But that operational design was not learned instantaneously. It was developed over time. And I think we're going to have a lot of quote-unquote everyday people that in the future, I hope, will have an opportunity to experience space in much the same way that I did. And our ability to design these future craft, these future housing entities in space, will go a long way in how good of an experience people will have when they actually are able to do it. So while commercial companies are feeling their way right now and the International Space Station is still sailing overhead, there's lots of work going on out there to create the next generation of I'll say, tourist attractions in outer space. I may be thinking too far ahead, but we want to help prepare our students to be more ready to be a part of that workforce that designs all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that hotel in space, when can we make reservations? And more importantly, what will the jacuzzi in my room look like, Clayton Anderson? That water's going to be all over the place.
Well, you know, it might not be a jacuzzi. It might be a holodeck, like on the Starship Enterprise.
Okay, I'd settle for that.
You never know.
Conversation I had last year with former astronaut Clayton Anderson, ISU graduate now. He's a Iowa State Distinguished Faculty Fellow, creator and instructor of the Spaceflight Operations Workshop at Iowa State University.
Where do you go when you're home? Where do you go when you're blue? Where do you go when you're lonely and following?
And finally today, how Grammy Award-winning songwriter Ryan Adams may have saved an Iowa musician's career with a single tweet. Joining me now, the Iowa musician in question, Chris Ford, a.k.a. Christopher the Conquered. He has a new album out, I'm Giving Up on Rock and Roll. Chris, are you there?
Yeah, how you doing, Ben?
Great, Chris, in our Ames studio. So this is the story of Ryan Adams tweeting about your new album. We want to hear something from your album in a moment, but tell us, how did this come to be?
Well, my album's not actually coming out until early next year, and but I have some advanced copies of it, and I played a show. So I keep them on me, and sometimes I give them to people that either I just really admire or that maybe, you know, would find it interesting, as I'm still trying to get some of the things in place to see that the album is as successful as possible as I've envisioned it. So anyway, basically the story is I played a show in Iowa City at the Mill, opening for a really great singer-songwriter named Natalie Press. I gave her a copy of the CD because I just wanted to see what she thought about it. She toured with Ryan Adams in Europe, and it seemingly made its way to him. I don't know why. I haven't talked to her about it. maybe she liked it. I don't know. And the next thing I knew is that he had tweeted the cover of the album and posted on Instagram saying really nice things. Like, this, he said, this is a crazy, incredible record. And he said, this album's blowing my mind. And things like that. And so that's how that happened.
What was your reaction when you saw that tweet?
Well, I was just like, well, that's really, really cool. And I kind of connected the pieces, you know, and I was like, that's great. Like, you know, that's hopefully, you know, that'll help me out. You know, it's like, it's kind of hard to tell.
Right. Did the social media for you blow up?
Well, not really, you know, but it did relatively to, like, you know, the story is that I was curious about that. So a week later, I was like, well, I'm going to try to, like, write down, like, everything that happened as a comparison to, like, where my traffic on, like, YouTube and Spotify and internet sales and all this stuff was, just to be like, what does happen here? And I posted, really what happened that was the big thing is that I posted those numbers on this website, Reddit, which we can explain if needed. But basically, people were really, really interested in that, and they voted to push it to the front page of Reddit, which gets millions of views a day. Mm-hmm. And it was on the very top of that website. And so that's actually where this whole story really started.
Okay, Chris, not much time left. We're aching to hear what Ryan Adams was all fired up about. I know your music. I know it's good. Let's listen to one of the tracks from your new album. This is called, a little bit of it, What's the Name of the Town? Let's have a listen.
Yeah.
What's the name of the town where the train stopped last night? What do they call it? Do they call it Denver? Or maybe it was Salt Lake or Omaha. Well, I ain't never seen a town like the one I saw. Now in this town there's a house and a glass for something sweeter. In each room piano stood tall and men sat upon them. And all those men cried out, you gotta open all the doors, I wanna let all the people hear. Pretty soon you're journeying on, heart the herald angels sing. All right now, what's the name of the town where the train stopped last night? What do they call it? Do they call it Chicago?
Okay, there's a little taste of Chris Ford, Christopher the Conquered, his new album coming out when, Chris?
Early 2016, but we're taking pre-orders now due to popular request on my website, christophertheconquered.com.
Okay, we're going to go out with a little bit more of your music in just a moment. So tell us about the title track. We don't have time to hear that, Giving Up on Rock and Roll. Was there a point? Were you going to give it up?
Well, there was a long time ago. Yeah, a few times for sure. Thanks to some good friends that really supported me, I was able to keep going. But when I wrote this song, it wasn't actually about giving up. It's actually about it was a moment in time when I realized that I had basically been allowing myself as a artist to become a version of myself that was what everybody liked the most about me, rather than just being sincere. So, you know, really, I was pretty moldable, and so I was changing a lot. And so this is a response to that.
Great, great music, Chris Ford. We're looking forward to hearing more of it. I'm Giving Up on Rock and Roll, the new album out. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Ben.
I can meet today, and she said, "That's all right, man. It's cool. I understand what you smell something coming in on the window."
All right, a little more Chris Ford to take us out. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.
You were looking real good. So what?